Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Encyclopedia of Life is an unprecedented global partnership between the scientific community and the general public. The goal is to make freely available to anybody knowledge about all, and I repeat, all the world's organisms. Anybody can register as a member and add text and images and videos, comments or tags to the pages, and then expert curators ensure the quality of the core collection by making sure the materials are authentic. This is a program that got rolling in 2007 and it has grown. We've talked about it a couple times. It's been about a year since we checked in to see how they're doing, and so we thought we would check in now. The first 30,000 pages of the website were unveiled online for the public back in February of 2007, and it was heralded as a leap for all of life. And we thought we would check in and see where they are right now, because it's just a phenomenal project. It's a consortium of all kinds of scientists and history museums and regular people who are adding to this. Imagine to have a database of all of the world's organisms. And of course, you're going to find some new organisms as well. We have two guests with us this hour to do an update. Tom Garnett is Program Director of the Biodiversity Heritage Library. Tom, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for being with us.
Hello.
Hello. Where are you?
I'm at the Smithsonian Institution's Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C.
Oh, the Smithsonians. We were just there a couple weeks ago. I love them. I have to come back, and I didn't get to yours. Oh, marvelous. Thank you very much for joining us. And Bob Corrigan is also joining us, Product Manager and Acting Deputy Director of the Encyclopedia of Life. Bob, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, gentlemen, how much progress has been made since we first talked about this many years ago?
Well, we've made just some extraordinary progress, even over the last year. You were mentioning that when the Encyclopedia of Life went live, there were about 30,000 pages. Over the last year, we've increased the number of pages 50%.
Woo!
And we now have species pages with text and or image content that are almost 700,000 have been documented, and we know we still have a long way to go. Scientists acknowledge there are about 1.9 million species that we know of that we've named, and of those, many are described only in some of the literature that Tom's group is busily scanning. But we're working with content providers. We have over 143 today. That's a tremendous growth over last year, over 100% increase. And the number of curators we have who are dedicating their time on a volunteer basis to review and comment and contribute to EOL as curators is now over 700, and that's grown 60% just over the last year. And over the last year, we had about 2.8 million visitors, which is also an increase over last year. So we're making tremendous progress, but we still have a very long way to go, and it's an exciting time.
What is the literature, Tom, that you are scanning that Bob referenced?
We're scanning the core literature of biodiversity. That's zoology, botany, mycology, that describes the species that form the biota of this Earth. This is highly specialized, extremely detailed work that has been produced by scientists since the time of Linnaeus.
My, my. And who do you have doing all of that work? Are these scientists all over the world combing the literature, or is it coming from you?
We have a consortium of 12 natural history and botanical libraries that have formed a consortium and that are digitizing materials from their collection. Much of the material is digitized with our partner project, the Internet Archive, but some of it is also scanned in-house by local scanning shops set up by these various libraries.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that there are all kinds of people all over the earth, and eventually everybody would be making use of this, a website that would list everything, a page of everything that's on Earth. Everybody would use it, wouldn't they?
We would certainly like to think so. And when we think about the different people who want to use EOL, we see many different communities, and these communities all have very specific needs. The scientific community is interested in a place where they can go to find definitive sources, to share their information with the world. The citizen science community, you could think of them as the activated amateurs, are really interested in engaging the professional community and finding ways to contribute, finding ways to learn new contexts and get access to the literature. And the general public, frankly, is really keen to have a repository of knowledge that they can trust, that draws on the literature that's published, that draws on the professional projects, draws on the work the scientists are doing, and brings it together in a way that's usable and accessible. And we're going the next step in a release we're working on this year to provide an encyclopedia of life that is internationalized. When we think about something that's internationalized, you could think of when you read Arabic. Arabic doesn't read left to right; it reads right to left.
Oh, I see.
And so, presenting an encyclopedia of life that is delivered in the language that people speak,
right,
that draws on language on content coming from different parts of the world in their native languages, if it's going to be useful to people all around the world, it has to be accessible to people all around the world. And we're very excited to see the increase in usage and the variety of usage.
When you say there are you expect to have information on 1.9 million species, how do we know that's about the number that we have? And who's to say there might be a lot of species that, once you really dig into this, exist that we never know existed?
Well, that's an extremely good question. There's approximately 1.9 million species that have been scientifically identified and have a scientific binomial name like Homo sapiens, you know. But nobody says that's the number of actually existing species. In fact, one of the impetuses for this project is to document what we already know and make it available to the world as a way of accelerating the discovery of the full biodiversity of the world. Estimates range orders of magnitude above that 1.9 million, 19 million, maybe 50 million species, many of which have yet to be discovered. So we hope the success of the Encyclopedia of Life and the Biodiversity Heritage Library will provide tools that will encourage and accelerate this process.
You know, when you say 1.9 million, it still stops you in your tracks. You can just think about that. 1.9 million. What do both of you think about the reason that there are so many species? That's a lot. 1.9 million and maybe 50 million. Why so many? You must think about that more than the average person.
That is a very, very fundamental scientific question. Why is there such diversity? What drives it? What are the forces that propel this forward? And there's many, many scientific debates about speciation. It's a fascinating topic.
I think it's fair to say that life adapts. And when it's stressed, it tries to adapt some more, or it fails. And we live in an extraordinary world that we're just beginning to understand. And with the dawn of the internet age and the availability of tools and the desire to share information, I think that forms the foundation of knowledge and discovery that people need in order to start asking more questions and start really engaging in a process of lifelong discovery. It's easy to walk around every day and not know the names of the living things around you. But once you start exploring and start seeing the diversity of life, one question leads to 10 more. Those 10 questions lead to 100. And all of that needs information that you can trust to form the foundation of that that process of inquiry.
Tell me about how it's obvious to me that it's good to know this just because it's good to know this. It's good to know what lives on Earth along with us. But tell me about the possibilities of use for this encyclopedia. Who would use it? People perhaps we haven't even thought of.
Well, I can give you some very straightforward examples of who would use it. If you were really interested in I'm going to project forward a few years. If you were going to go on a walk and you wanted to know the sorts of trees you could expect to find on your walk. And you were going to, say, describe that you're going to be walking in a park. You could imagine that you might want to go to the internet, find a map, draw a shape on it, or just find, this is Rock Creek Park here in this area, and it would give you a field guide of what you could expect to see, some other people who had seen it, what was flowering this time of year. If you were interested in going and looking at mushrooms and wanted to know which ones in your area were safe to eat and which ones weren't, you might want to have a list in that area. And if you were looking to find the connections that existed from one species to many other and find, you know, uncover those relationships, really peel them back, any number of different people might want to ask those questions and want to go to a place where that information was readily available. Every school kid here in the States goes through a project looking at state flowers. But what is the definitive source you can go to learn about that, that then connects that state flower to other things and really draws them in? So many different people we envision as users, and our challenge is not just to gather information, but to provide ways to put this information into usable context, to bring people into the community, and then ground it in the literature that has been developed and continues to be developed as the foundation of scientific discovery. So it's really trying to anticipate usage, anticipate the data you need, acquire it, and then create relationships with communities that we can learn about and then support over time.
Tom, you want to add anything?
Well, another key component is it's interactive. The Encyclopedia of Life, even today, and more so as it grows, provides information to users searching, but also allows users to upload images and sightings that they have made. I think I saw a robin, find a page for a robin, and you can upload the image that you took. It will be marked as not fully vetted, but then and at some point a ornithologist, one of our curators, will verify that is or is not a species. So it creates, especially for an educational context, a sense of your involvement in the site. It's not just an encyclopedia out there. It's something that you can actually contribute to, especially for high school and college students. This creates a strong buy-in and further interest.
It sure does.
I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah. Well, let's look at the ocean for a moment, because it's my understanding that there's a lot in the ocean that we don't even know it exists. And there have been some remarkable discoveries recently about these animals that are there that we never knew they were there, and they're extraordinary. And some of them are living for a long period of time, and some of them would scare the daylights out of you if you saw one of them when you were scuba diving. How are we looking at the ocean? How is that a part of what we're trying to, the information we're trying to gather?
Well, the study of marine life is something that is very near and dear to EOL, because it was our first theme, it was our first focus. And working with providers like FishBase, we were able to populate EOL from the very beginning with some very rich data. But more recently, a project known as the Census of Marine Life just completed. And that was really an unprecedented 10-year effort to go around the world and look into the dark corners of the ocean, look at areas that hadn't been explored in a long time, many that had not been looked at before, and take a true census. And after 10 years, they discovered some remarkable things, and those are all online at the Census of Marine Life website, coml.org. And the new discoveries that came out of that, the papers that were produced as part of that and published to the Public Library of Science, are all linked to the Encyclopedia of Life.
Wonderful.
And this is another example of species discovery is an ongoing thing. It's not like something that was done in the 19th century only. We have and are and will uncover vast new swaths of animals. I mean, we're even still discovering mammals and vertebrates. But once you get into invertebrates and coccolithophores and other marine life forms, there's so much more to discover. And these are very important for major Earth processes like taking in of carbon, carbon sequestration, and the carbon cycle. People discuss climate change and global warming, right, issues like that. There's an immense biological component that we're still trying to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Who are these critters out there, and how much carbon do they take in, and how much oxygen do they give off?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a field of very important research. So documenting the full spectrum of what is out there is really the first step.
Plus, it probably has, and who knows where this will go, but I would imagine it will learn a lot about aging, because some of these critters are living for a long period of time, and maybe medicine as well, right?
Bob?
Absolutely. I mean, unless you're actively discovering and searching, all of the secrets that these species are hiding, all of the knowledge you can gain from learning about them, how they interact with their environment, what they're made of, where they come from, how they thrive, how they what threatens them, they help fill in the blanks of the picture of the living world that we inhabit alongside with them. It's not as if humanity rides above life on our planet. We're all on the same boat. And as we discover more about them, we gain insights that, frankly, we're not going to discover elsewhere.
We welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're talking about the Encyclopedia of Life. It's a venture. The goal is to make freely available knowledge about all the world's organisms. And that, of course, would include finding some new organisms. As you're looking at what exists, you find out there are things that exist that you didn't even know existed, which we have seen pictures of and heard remarkable stories from the census of marine life. But scientists and regular people all over the world are doing this, and history museums and all over the world are involved in this huge, huge project to scientifically identify the 1.9 million species that we know about. But as one of our guests said, who knows, it might be 19 million or it might be 50 million. We just don't know. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And we sure do welcome your thoughts, your questions. You can get involved in this, too. We'll give you more information about how you can help identify species. Our guests are Tom Garnett, who is Program Director of the Biodiversity Heritage Library, joining us by phone from the Smithsonian Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C. Bob Corrigan is Product Manager and Acting Deputy Director of the Encyclopedia of Life. Please join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Encyclopedia of Life, our conversation this hour. Our phone number again, join us if you'd like, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. If we could, gentlemen, let's talk about how citizens can participate in this. We can help identify species and then they're verified. How do citizens become involved?
Well, there are a number of ways that individuals can become involved. The first thing is just to visit EOL.org. And another opportunity is we have a Flickr group, F-L-I-C-K-R. And what we allow folks to do is we give them the ability to, whether just using Flickr or even an iPhone application that we have, to take pictures and upload them to an Encyclopedia of Life group. And those are, if you know the name of it, you can put the name on the picture. If you don't know the name of it, you could put some messages with it. And that information is reviewed by curators on Flickr. And also it gets swept into the Encyclopedia of Life and then associated with the various pages. We've got a really interesting infrastructure that takes all of these different inputs from our partners, from our content providers, from curators, from regular folks, and then organizes and classifies and sorts them based on the species. That's just what we can do today. In the future, coming up later this year, people will be able to get involved and come to the Encyclopedia of Life and create their own virtual collections, things they've seen on a walk, things they're interested in.
Oh, my.
Creatures that they want to know about, or perhaps if for citizen scientists and specialists, particular virtual collections that reflect their areas of interest. And then they'll have the ability to share these with other users and have those EOL virtual collections be affiliated with communities on EOL. So our hope is that not just by having a lot of information, but we want to be able to give people the ability to make it personal, to bring it together, to share it.
Right.
And ultimately, because we're a digital resource, we offer people the ability to access EOL through their own applications, through apps. So people are building apps today that use EOL as an ingredient, and some very interesting things are being done. One recent one was an application called LeafSnap that some folks here at the museum and Columbia and other institutions have been working on, where you can go into Rock Creek Park, some other parks, take a picture of a leaf, and it will go ahead and identify that tree for you.
Oh,
and then it
draws
into it information, supplemental information from the Encyclopedia of Life to give you some more information.
So you really needed to have a certain level of high tech to make this project even conceivable, didn't you?
We really did, and not just for the infrastructure of the Encyclopedia of Life, but the scanning and digitization and the optical character recognition work that goes into the Biodiversity Heritage Library is also something that just has not been possible at a grand scale until the last 4 or 5 years, and is really taking off now. Tom, do you want to touch on that a little bit?
We take pictures of pages and books. And so we have images of those, and then we have software that converts those images into text that can be read and manipulated and searched and indexed by a computer, optical character recognition. So we put these two together to create the Biodiversity Heritage Library, which provides the textual underpinnings. We've done well over 90,000 volumes, 33 million individual text pages, and what we're creating now is really a graduate-level library in zoology and botany. This is very important in the developing world, where you have many people who are very interested in botany and zoology because of the great biodiversity of their countries, but it's difficult for local colleges and universities to run graduate-level programs because they lack the resources that graduate schools do have here in the United States. We're now getting to the point where, thanks to the effort of the Biodiversity Heritage Library and the Encyclopedia of Life, that people in Guatemala, Costa Rica, in Africa can actually be doing graduate level study because they have resources that formerly were unavailable to them. Formerly they would have to travel to New York or Washington D.C. or London to access material. It's now available to them in their home countries.
Oh, that's just wonderful. Wonderful.
And we get these testimonials and emails of just uses to which they are able to put the stuff that an American graduate school in zoology would take for granted, but was not available to people in developing countries.
And now it is. Is this material, this encyclopedia, include all forms of life that were once living in addition to that which is living now, or it's just living now?
Go ahead.
Trying to tackle those that are living now or have recently gone extinct. In the long run, of course, we'd like to do the paleontological record. But right now we're focused on current biodiversity. One of the driving forces here, of course, is so much of it is going extinct before we even fully understand it. So a certain urgency to documenting as fully as possible those species that are extant now.
And for both of you, I don't want to put you on the spot, but the media loves to concentrate on a discovery of something new or a discovery of a species that lives 600 years and we didn't know that, or something we've never seen before who looks odd. Have there been discoveries along the way, Tom and Bob, that you just marvel at? You say, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this exists.
I'm gonna put you on the spot first there, because I've got my favorite.
Okay.
Bob?
Well, one of the things that I just can't recall the name of it right now, so but there was some recent surveys of deep-sea vents where you would imagine that the conditions were so abhorrent and so just absolutely intense that no life could thrive, and yet there was life down there. Under Arctic ice, under just the most extraordinary circumstances, life manages to find a way to exist and in many cases thrive in places where you would never expect it. And it's the thrill of the unexpected, the thrill of the surprise is part of the excitement of being in this field. But it also helps unlock ideas on how life could possibly how life could thrive elsewhere under even more extreme circumstances. And I think as we build better understanding of how life adapts under different circumstances on this planet, I think it unlocks a basis of knowledge we can use wherever we happen to go as a species.
Mm-hmm. Tom?
Another example of kind of the immediate relevance is the Encyclopedia of Life has, though we're not complete, has many, 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 many species pages. In response to the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, 2010, that had immense repercussions for the biota of that area, repercussions that we're only beginning to understand now. Well, within a short space of time, there's a whole Gulf of Mexico oil spill page now on the Encyclopedia of Life, with listing links to Gulf of Mexico species, the habitats, and other information. And you can actually get very, very detailed information. You can get the big picture and then go down to the species level and learn about what was there and the state of knowledge at particular points in time.
Oh, that's interesting. Somehow that information needs to get to the broader public, because a lot of the news coverage of the aftermath of that spill is so inconsequential. They say, oh, things are back to normal. Well, it sounds like they're not.
It's a lot of research still needs to occur to be able to make that claim. I think that claim needs a bit more looking at.
Mm-hmm. When you talked about the number of species that are going extinct and you need to gather this information because of the rapidity that this is happening, why are things going extinct so quickly? What's going on?
There's many, 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 many reasons. Their habitats are disappearing. And that could be due to urbanization, could be due to agriculture, could be due to desertification. Climate is changing. There are hosts and hosts of factors that lead to extinction. Some of these are human-created. And we need to understand this, which is why, as a first step, you need to know first what is there before you can track if it's extinct. I mean, we can track extinction of known species, but for all those many, many species that have yet to be identified, they could go extinct before we were even aware of it. And these are not just obscure things. I mean, we're talking about species that may have important roles in the ecosystem in which we live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think very often there's a sense when we talk about extinction that all extinction is related to people walking around and doing something they shouldn't be doing. and while I think it's reasonable to make certain statements that, you know, human activity is leading to destruction of certain ecosystems, certainly the expansion of farmland in Brazil is having a, you know, extreme impact on the forest there. The straightforward answer is we just don't know. And unless you're paying attention to what's happening around you, you can miss very subtle signals of some very big moves. And at the end of the day, better information gathered in a consistent way and presented in a way that's comprehensive should support better decisions. And we feel that the work that EOL is doing, the work that the Biodiversity Heritage Library is doing, is gathering information that can be used to make good decisions, and that should lead to better outcomes.
Yeah, if you can trust the decision makers, it hasn't always happened in the past, has it?
Maybe, but I think I want to emphasize Bob's point. We are not an advocacy group, and it's not because we don't have strong feelings about many environmental issues. But our primary goal is to document what is known and provide and present it in as useful and clear a way as possible. And if there are differing views in the literature, well, we'll do both of them, because without valid, vetted, well-presented information, decisions are made in a vacuum, and people rely on just on very incomplete pieces of data, and that doesn't lead to very good policy.
Absolutely. Well, have you entertained the thought of being advocates?
What I do in my personal life is sure. But I can't. But I mean, there, even within science, forgetting issues about environmental policy, there are valid disagreements about all sorts of things. This species belongs in this genus, or it belongs in that genus. Mm-hmm. How you organize and classify things, and we're neutral.
I think if there's anything that I feel strongly that we should advocate for is, and it's really stated well in our vision statement for the Encyclopedia of Life, is we believe in global knowledge about life on Earth. And without that global knowledge, without the ability to gather, present, and share it with people wherever they are, whatever language they speak, whatever their circumstances, we are not providing something that is essential to understanding our place on the planet and our ability to inhabit it in a way that is sustainable and productive. So that is at the heart of our advocacy. We want to create this repository, this digital resource that's freely accessible, that's open, that makes this knowledge of life on Earth available to everyone. And if we don't do it, who is?
Right.
That's our job.
Right. Yeah. Our guests this hour are involved in giving us global knowledge about all life on Earth. It's really a phenomenal, phenomenal project. We learned of it a couple of years ago, and we're checking in now to see what they've been able to gather in the last year since we last spoke with them, and it's been an incredibly productive year. Bob Corrigan is Product Manager, Acting Deputy Director of the Encyclopedia of Life. Tom Garnett is Program Director of the Biodiversity Heritage Library. And we're talking about all that's been going on to understand more and to put on the web information, one page for each of the 1.9 million species on Earth, but as a result of classifying all this information and giving it to the whole world, they will find species that they never knew existed. And there's also, as they were just talking about, we need to get going on this because there are species that are going extinct before we even understand about their existence. So it has, you can imagine, all kinds of ramifications here, just beyond, and many beyond the fact of just it's good to know with what and whom we're sharing the Earth and why there are so many different species. It just is pretty remarkable, isn't it? Join our conversation if you'd like to. You can just listen if you want, but I'm sure that some of you would like to know about more about this project or how you can participate in this project, the worthwhile nature of this, and what the applications of this information might be. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you want to send an email, you can do that, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our guests are Bob Corrigan, Acting Deputy Director of the Encyclopedia of Life. Tom Garnett is Program Director for the Biodiversity Heritage Library. And we welcome your phone calls and your emails, too, about this. Here's an email that's come in, gentlemen. Does the number cited include all of the bacteria, single cell, I don't know how to pronounce this, algae, protozoa, et cetera, as well as viruses not included as living, but they replicate?
The quick answer is no.
Okay.
There's a lot of them, and they're fairly promiscuous at the rate at which they share genetic material. So even what you call a species is sometimes a very fluid thing. So there is an awful lot of information in EOL on single-celled critters. Tom, do you have a take on that?
One of the primary distinctions in the classification of living beings is between eukaryotes and prokaryotes. The 1.9 figure refers to eukaryotic life. Those are cells that have nuclei. So they could be unicellular or multicellular. This is distinguished from prokaryotes and viruses, which don't. So in that 1.9 million number doesn't include bacteria and viruses. And that number, by the way, is an estimate, 1.9 million.
My two new words of the day, eukaryote and prokaryote.
Yeah. Bacteria are prokaryotes. They lack organized nuclei.
Okay. See what happens when you hang out with scientists?
I know, it's great. I'm loving it.
My background, I have a life sciences degree. I spent 20 years in the commercial software business and was invited to join the Encyclopedia of Life to help manage and run it as a vibrant, almost professional service. So this is, the last year has been enormously exciting for me, and you know the sense that you go into work every day and learn something with people who are so astoundingly smart is a real terrific experience.
I'm sure. Let's go to Edith from Waukesha. Hi, Edith.
Hi.
Hi.
I really am enjoying this program. I have a question though. How will we be able to learn how to use this fabulous information? When it is done, your encyclopedia is done, and I am 72 years old, and I have not had computer science in school. So I sort of hope that somehow there will be some way that those of us who are in that age group could learn how to do this.
Well, I can say first of all that people in your age group are certainly capable of extraordinary things, and one of the things that's so satisfying about working on the Encyclopedia of Life is knowing that we have to build it in such a way that it can be used by anybody who can put their hands on a mouse or can sit in front of a computer and bring up a website and see some wonderful pictures or type in a name. And be able to explore in a way that's very intuitive without having to really have a computer science background at all. And one of the challenges we're facing right now, we've been working on it for almost the last whole year, is building a new version of the Encyclopedia of Life website that really draws you in and makes it so wonderfully usable and so intuitive that whether you're 10 years old or 70 years old or anywhere in between, that you can have a really satisfying experience and explore and discover something new without really having to be an expert at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have reached an age, though, don't you think, gentlemen, where we simply are going to have to learn to use some of this technology because the information will be on our computer now. It couldn't be in your library at home because there would be way too many books.
You're absolutely right. And I guess with the advent of tools like the iPad that you can pick up and poke with your finger,
Right.
Find something, you know, that looks good and tap on a picture and learn more about it. We have the tools available to us to build delightful experiences for people who may want to use is their finger to navigate and learn.
Yes.
But it's really up to us to make those experiences delightful,
mm-hmm.
because it's possible to have very bad experiences on the web.
Mm-hmm.
I want to assure your caller that my mother-in-law, who's in her 80s and grew up without computers and does not know much about computers, has used the Encyclopedia of Life and finds it fascinating because though it is built on very advanced technologies, it doesn't require familiarity on the part of the user. So if you can read and if you can type or point and click, you can search and find things of great interest in the Encyclopedia of Life. It doesn't require a technical background, doesn't require a scientific background. Though, of course, if you have a scientific background, you can also make use of it, too.
Yes, of course. I mean, I would agree that there are a whole chunk of us who are, you know, getting up there in years, not really old yet, but we never learned how to do a lot of these things on computers that our children know how to do just instantaneously. I see her point that we all are missing some of that knowledge that will allow us to fully use our computers. Aren't we?
Well, I think if you can, over the last 10 years, you've really seen a movement towards creating computing experiences that are very intuitive. To making technology accessible. And I think that's been the case for many different technologies for years. I mean, you used to have to do some pretty interesting tricks to keep your food fresh. Now you just plug in a refrigerator and your food won't spoil, or at least it won't spoil as quickly.
Right.
And, you know, the computing is very much the same way. Elegance masks complexity, but elegance promotes use.
Mm-hmm.
And nature in many ways is the same way. You see enormously complex relationships expressed in very elegant ways. And that doesn't mean we can't go out and enjoy a tree if we don't understand photosynthesis.
Mm, interesting. Let's go to Greg in Green Bay. Hi, Greg.
Hi, I'm familiar with Galaxy Zoo, which basically does the same thing. It lets people sort through all these millions of pictures of galaxies and categorize them and so forth, in essence taking a lot of work off of the grad student's desk and puts it onto, you know, citizen scientists. I'm wondering, do you believe that this is going to change the way science is going to be done in the future?
Hmm.
And do you think that this is going to, as a side effect, improve science education?
Well, the two questions you're asking, is this going to change how science is done? And I want to talk to that one first, because I think Tom has some strong thoughts on the second one. One of the things that Encyclopedia of Life has is, at its foundation, is an all-of-life perspective. And over time, our ambition is to bring not just text information in so you could read about a species, but to bring computable information in. And it, since the very first days of the Encyclopedia of Life, we've had this idea of a macroscope to be able to look at life from way high up, to see big, to see the movement at a high level, to ask questions of a very large database on information that's at a summary level for a species, such as how many eggs do they lay, or how long do they live, or what's their body mass. And so when you bring information together in a way that is comprehensive and computable, you start having an opportunity to ask big questions in a way that was never possible before. We have a group out at the Field Museum Chicago that's engaged in the work of biodiversity synthesis, and this is exactly what they are exploring in their work. How can the Encyclopedia of Life allow you to ask big questions wherever you are, and then connect from those big questions to more focused areas of inquiry? With regards to science education, Tom, what are your thoughts on that?
Much of the way science has been communicated past has been via text and printed pages. and scientific journals. There is a sea change, a revolution in how, across all scientific disciplines, in how scientific findings and scientific information is communicated, because it's still partially textual, partially digital, and various combinations. And there are whole new relationships being created here. And we are right in the swim of it, so to speak. Many scientific modes of communication are moving to web-based digital modes, yet an area that I'm especially interested in is how do we keep track and preserve the scientific record. Science moves on, but you need to be able to say in 2005 such and such was perceived, such and such was discovered, such and such was argued. So how we preserve this more fluid environment as we transition to a digital environment is something that I'm very, very involved in.
I also just want to give a shout out to Galaxy Zoo and Zooniverse. Robert Simpson, is a gentleman I spoke with. He's one of the key guys over at Galaxy Zoo and Zooniverse, which is kind of their umbrella organization. They are changing how astronomy is done. There was a Dutch school teacher, Hanny van Arkel, in 2007, was looking at a galaxy from the Sloan Sky Survey, and just her eye went a little bit south of it, and she saw some green gaseous shapes in this photograph, and she didn't know what it was, and asked some questions, and all of a sudden the scientific community picked up on it. So Galaxy Zoo, Zooniverse, eBird, projects like that are all engaging people to participate in science in a meaningful way. Because if you had to pay a graduate student to do the sort of work that these folks are doing, they'd be working 24/7 for years. And by getting enlightened, engaged, and interested people to participate in the work of science, we're able to scale tasks that in the past would have taken years and do it much faster. And that's exciting.
That is exciting. You got more people who care about it and who are informed and looking at things. So, of course, you're going to come up with discoveries quicker, huh?
You'd like to think so. When you've got more people working on a problem, you know, it just reminds me of Tom Sawyer painting the fence.
Right, exactly. And please, before we have to say goodbye to both of you, give us more of a sense of the enormity of this project. You've got museums all over the world working on this. You've got scientists who have been exploring the oceans, ships from all over the world. Give me a sense of how big it is.
I'll wrap up with an organizational thought.
Okay.
Yeah, there are partner projects that are working on the same issue in multiple countries: China, Chinese Academy of Sciences, Egypt, Bibliotheca Alexandrina, Australia, Atlas of Living Australia. Europe, the 22 libraries have a biodiversity heritage library in Europe. So we started off primarily U.S.-based, North American-based, but it's generated a lot of interest with peer institutions that have formed projects, similar projects. So this has been very, very rewarding to see this response to this attempt, because it's going to require a global effort to actually do this in an effective way.
Mm-hmm. And Bob?
You know, I can't add much of anything to what Tom said, but when you think about the enormity of trying to gather information on all of life, this is information that's sitting in databases, on CDs and scientists' drawers, in libraries. We've been observing nature since we crawled out of the cave. And we've been documenting it very well, but in a way that is just not organized. And if you were to imagine the world's collective knowledge of biodiversity as one great big junk drawer, we're sorting around and finding and connecting information every day from new providers, from new scientists, from new communities, and trying to like wire it up into a platform that not only presents it in a consistent way, but allows people to go through and explore the sources where it comes from. So Encyclopedia of Life, the Biodiversity Heritage Library, is an enormous task, but really we see it as an opportunity to connect knowledge of life and the explorers who care about life with the people who need to become engaged in understanding life. And I could think of no more worthy thing to be spending with my time.
Oh, thank you both so much. What a fascinating project, and our thanks.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Bob Corrigan.
Thank you for your time, too.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Bob Corrigan is Deputy Director of Encyclopedia of Life, and Tom Garnett, who is Program Director of the Biodiversity Heritage Library. Go to eol.org for more information, or Google Encyclopedia of Life and learn a lot more. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show and for on-air production. We'll be with you again tomorrow.